It's time for Bajan Rhythm and Rhyme. And at this time, we say good evening to Sluggy Dan and his special guests who we have on the line. Welcome this evening.
Manners, and we say greetings, everyone. This is your boy, Sluggy Dan, and thanks for tuning in to Bajan Rhythm and Rhyme with VOB 92.9 every Saturday at 6 p.m. And welcome a very, very special guest, LaShawna and the legendary Mr. Roger Gittings. Good evening to both of you.
Good evening, Sluggy.
Yes, good evening, sir. And we, of course, ladies first. So, LaShawna.
Yes, please.
Right, before we go ahead, how are you coping with the corona?
I am doing well. Today is my mom's 50th birthday, so, you know, we are celebrating her. Outside of that, I'm cool. I'm writing more and looking to produce more content.
Well, good. You got to make sure you say hello. Hello to mom for me.
I will.
Yes. First, I want to let everyone know, because you have been doing historic things. So it needs to let everyone know who LaShawna is.
Okay. LaShawna Griffith is a 26-year-old author and published poet. She has 3 collections of work: LaShawna Unlocked the Door, LaShawna Released the Energy Within, and Rogue. Today, funny enough, will make 5 years that I have been a published writer. I would have published my first book, Unlocked the Door, on my mom's 45th birthday. So I am feeling a bit happy right now. I won Writer of the Year 2019 from Guidon's People's Choice Awards back in March. And then a few weeks ago, I was nominated for the iWoman Global Award 2020 in the category of literature, which was a great feat because I would be the only Barbadian and the only person from the Caribbean to actually be in international award nomination, because each year iWoman looks for someone who is pioneering in their own right in various disciplines. So to be nominated is crazy. And to be nominated at 26 is even crazier, you know. That's it in a nutshell, who I am.
And you're the only Caribbean person?
Yeah, only person for any Caribbean. Any competition right now, there are persons from Los Angeles. There are
person or female?
Female, so it's an all-female competition, I should say. So it's only females in. So there are persons from Los Angeles, there are persons from UK, India, Italy, Indonesia, Philippines, you name it, someone is nominated in various categories from each part of the world. So you're going up against the best writers from every part of the world, and you're competing to take home that trophy for your respective island.
Right, you reside right here in Barbados. You play your craft in Barbados. You don't live outside of Barbados, but you're a Barbadian?
Yeah, I live here. I've lived here all my life. I only traveled once to the U.S., and I came right back. a friend of mine, funny enough, who is a finalist in this year's 2019 iWoman category in literature, she would have recommended me. And then told me about it after the fact. So obviously I was shocked when she told me she recommended me to the committee. And then I had to submit a whole set of documents, and I was holding my breath to see if I would be allowed to be official nominee first before I broke the news or told anyone. I didn't tell my mom at first until I got the official email saying I'm in, because I didn't want to say, and then you don't know if you get through, you know what I mean?
So how do you make all these moves? How do you make all these moves and internationally and from right here? Because spoken word or the art you do, you know, may not see it on media or hear on media as much. How do you still manage to navigate and swim in international waters and be recognized from home?
Well, I would say that I must thank, I want to start by saying Chatterhouse Books, but still myself, because when I first started writing my books, having my first book out, I would have gone the route of having it on Amazon, and I was doing all the marketing, all the promotion myself. And then around maybe in my first year, I would have met Erica Hinkson at Bimlet Fest, and she really would have, you know, explained the way in which I could, through Chatterhouse Books, get further promotion and further have my name further afield. And to get on the international market, I was strategic in going on Amazon, because Amazon gives you every single Amazon site worldwide that my book is on. So the name will be out there. And then, you know, I would promote on Facebook. And each person that tells me thank you, or each person that says, well, they like my book, I would always thank them regardless, because I wouldn't know who they are. And then persons would inbox me and say, hey, well, I am someone from World Poetry Canada. I'm looking to feature you as you're doing good things. And then it would just happen organically. So when all of that started to happen, obviously you would promote yourself more on social media. Then you had the international features. Then I was in anthologies, two anthologies. So the name was out there. To the point that my mom recently said, LaShawna, Google, you ever Google yourself? And I was like, what? I said, like, somebody tell me that when you Google your name, all these things has come up. And I was like, oh, oh, because I'm not that vain, you know. I don't really go about doing certain things like that, like Googling myself or checking to see. I would try to see, like, the rankings of my books and stuff. But outside of that, you know, I just live day to day.
Well, nice. So this is something that you will see. We need more young people in. There's a market for more of our young persons to get involved in this.
I think I always say that there is a market, because right now I am competing. For example, I had one of my books was ranked the hottest new release in Caribbean and Latin American literature, right? When my third book wrote first came out. But the issue with that is, obviously, there are only 550 Barbadian authors. To date, there could be more. That's the last time I got the numbers from Chatterhouse Books. We're going up against persons from, like, the Latin America countries, so like Cuba, Spain, Ecuador, Mexico, Italy, and they have billions of people. So obviously when they release a book, their whole country backing them, and they will got a million of reviews and a million of comments, and then they will, the book quick, so the book going up to number one, because they got a lot of writers that writing. So the bigger the pool is, the more you can earn from it. And I find in Barbados, one of the things that we fall down in, we got a lot of authors that booked on Amazon, but they don't market them and they don't show you who they are. So you never know the face behind this book. Get what I mean? So like the general public may not know, like, for example, the general public may not know that like DJ Simmons got books that out. Empress Zingo got books. Adrian Green got CDs and stuff that he would have done over the years. But people don't know about it, because I guess that the way it was marketed, you know, and brought over, like Esther Phillips, our poet laureate, got a lot of books.
Esther Phillips, yeah, I hear that name a lot.
Amazon. And a lot of people, if you ask them who she is, they may not necessarily know. Outside of she's the poet laureate, they may not be able to name her books offhand.
Right, but it's still a market that she's in and thriving in.
Yeah, but there are some young authors that I must say that are coming up. There's a young lady, Irija. She's releasing a book in June. There's Daniel Boxell, who's also releasing a book very, very soon.
So nice, they are all young Barbadians.
Yeah, so the younger generation are releasing some books really, really soon. And that's something to look out for. But I will say that we need to have more Barbadian poets. And I mean, like, is becoming an art form that is more popular now. You know, because you see children in school and doing the chanting. And you're seeing persons like Christopher Leslie and Raquan and Devon St. Hill coming up. You know, person that under the tutelage of Winston Farrell. But I feel like it needs to be more done with poetry, like in the schools.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, because poetry, pick of the, let me say pick of the crop, social commentary, and all of these other art forms all start from having a knowledge of how to write, how to phrase, how to even picon. Because people may think picon is this separate thing from poetry, but picon is like a spoken word to music, you know. Because it's like a diss. What rappers would consider a diss track.
Okay.
You know?
Right. Yeah, I get it. So, BB, before we go, though, can we get a sample of one of your before we go? Please.
Sure. Yeah. I'm pulling it up, sorry. I have it here.
Look at his name. What was the name of this piece? When was it written?
I could try to pull up something that a little fresh.
Fresh, Mr. Fresh, you mean written recently?
Yeah.
Well, nice. And you do any collaborative work when you write? You know, you write all of your art yourself.
There's only one single piece in my entire body of work that I did not write. It made NIFCA semifinals around 2013. It was called Front Page, and it was written by a guy, Andrew Yearwood. And I have been trying to get in contact with him. So if he's listening, I really would like to hear him, because the piece has been one of my most recommended pieces, even in my gigs. And I really would like to talk to him and see, you know, what he thinks of the journey that I've been having since I went to him to get that piece in around early 2013 for NIFCA.
Also, you're not sure if he's still over there or he's doing work?
Well, I'm not sure. The person that would have introduced me to him, she doesn't have a number for him either, so I don't know.
Well, no, I like these stories and these first dropping pen barely in my ring. So his name is Andrew who?
Andrew Yearwood.
Hey, Andrew Yearwood, if you're out there listening, this is Bass Rhythm and Rhyme. Your boy Sluggy Dan. LaShawna would love to get in contact with you. She's written some work for her and is years ago and is still doing very, very well. And this is 7 years after. I think that is great. And we need to know who you are as well, my brother. And if you're still in the field, keep up the great work. All right, LaShawna, you ready for us?
Yeah, I just trying to. Oh, good, I got it.
So you ready?
So this piece, I want to give a little backstory. This piece was inspired by a lady named Violet. She's homeless, and I would have met her doing my errands in Bridgetown about a month ago. What stood out about Violet, as you were hearing the piece, is that despite her being homeless, she was still approachable and still wishing everyone good wishes, even though these people did not give her anything when she asked. So I listened to what she had to say. We had a long conversation, and I decided to write this piece. It's called Carnival Flavor, a tribute to Violet. She was spunky, well-dressed with a sense of hurt in her eyes. She lived in a dilapidated house. She had no money, but she prayed for me. She had missing teeth. Her shoes were full of holes, and her backpack had seen better days. But despite her being rejected by each person she asked by a popular supermarket, she smiled and wished them well. I watched her conversate with her Trinidad accent potent as she explained her plight and how she got to be in her position. Said she was dying from a medical condition called AIDS. Guess that's why no one came to her aid. Despite them having bags of groceries and bales of toilet paper, they scorned her and ignored her cries for help. I looked at her, and I felt inclined to assist. After all, she's the same human as me. She has feelings, and with this pandemic, she must have food to eat. And as I listened to her story, I watched her thank me profusely for the 5 items I was able to give, and I was there hoping I could give more. But despite the items being small in stature, she prayed for me. She prayed for me. Her name matched her demeanor, as she wasn't letting life hold her down. She was homeless, house exposed to the elements, but determined to love. She spoke about her children and her days of attending Carnival, and her face lit up. Oh, how she smiled as she told me about her days in a masquerade. And if she was in a better situation, she would go to Trinidad next year to party. She smiled and said, "Nice to meet you. I'm Violet, and you're a nice person to listen and help." I smiled. She was so nice. Her smile was infectious. Her zeal for life was inspiring as her financial situation or her health situation wasn't keeping her down. She was powerful in faith and love, and she prayed for me. She prayed for me. Watch and see, you know how God gonna bless you for helping me. She smiled and said. I said, "Thank you for teaching me to be more compassionate and loving." She smiled and said, "Get home safe." She packed her bag and offered up one more prayer before she started to walk on her journey to her house, exposed to the elements. But her shoulders were not slumped. Her face wasn't sluggy. She was happy and pleased to now have a meal to go prepare as she swayed her hips humming through Bridgetown. As she is more than a homeless woman, she is Violet, a beautiful soul filled with Trinidadian flavor.
You still there?
Yeah, that's it. That's the end.
That was very deep. You see, this was inspired by an actual person.
Yeah. So every time I went to town, I went into town up to last week, and I would have seen Violet again. And she conversation, you know, I kept on telling her, you know, I think that you need to go to the Vagrant and Homeless Society and go to the shelter. And she told me, I'm going to go. But each time I see her, she doesn't go. But we have really good conversations, you know.
She knows about this piece?
Yeah. I spoke to her and told her I was writing something about her, and she said she was honored. And she's such a very happy person. Like, her circumstance is not getting her down. And
oh, nice. You let her hear the lyrics and stuff?
Well, no, I did not. I was not finished when I last saw her, but I told her that I was working on something inspired by her, and she was so happy. And we stood and we chatted. She told me about her days in Trinidad and, you know, her children. And, you know, we became, I can say that really and truly we're friends. Because every time she sees me, she calls me by name. She holler for me hard. She's like, Shauna girl. And I'd be like, "Yeah, Violet, what's going on?" And she's
that's
like,
great. That's Shauna on the real, that is so awesome. Like, you know, like, two people meet at different places in life, but still share a special place. And then as a result, beautiful art can motivate and still build a friendship. Because sometimes a nice word is always wanted, though. Like, so I really, really want to tell you thanks for doing that. And I want to tell you thanks for speaking to us at Bezzy Rhythm and Rhyme. Keep doing historic things. Only one in the Caribbean for the award, a woman. I think that is phenomenal. You're doing phenomenal things at your age. And thanks for being friends of VOB 92.9. Say hello to mommy for me. Show the family. And
I
pray that all goes well for you in your journey, LaShauna. I truly want to thank you
so much. Thank you so much. And I must say thank you so much to you, Sluggy, because I find you're really allowing young people to shine on your Bezzy Rhythm and Rhymes. And it's really needed in these times especially, you know?
Man, thank you very much, man. It was done to me, so I just paint it for, you know, a longer term deserving that. So that's all I'm trying to do, but I really respect you for that, and enjoy the rest of your day, man.
I will. I'm going to cut my mom's birthday cake right now, because she...
Yes. All right, bye-bye.
All right, yeah, later.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
All right, Ronnie.
Yes, sir.
Yes, we're ready for the maestro now.
We are indeed. Perhaps at this point, we can. In fact, let's not do that yet until we get the confirmation. But nevertheless, let me say that in 2012, the announcer had cause to work with Roger Gittins at the expressed direction of his regular producer Pernell Farley because of the commitments that Pernell had at that time. And Boxy Theology was totally rearranged from what it originally was in 2004. and made it straight to the finals. Roger Gideon, he's done so many songs. He most probably forgot about that. But then when you're working with people like Adrian, you can't remember the announcer anyway.
I'm sure that he remembers that. Good evening, sir. Excuse all manners and forgive Ronnie. Good evening, Mr. Roger Gittes. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for coming on the Beat of Rhythm and Rain.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
And of course, you remember what Ronnie's speaking about, right?
Yeah, I remember working with Ronnie. It was quite interesting because Ronnie has a lot of ideas too. So it was a situation where we combined what I was thinking and what he was thinking. It worked. I think it worked really well at the end of the day. Yeah,
indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you were with, and it really mentioned Adrian. Name.
Adrian.
And of course, he's speaking about the great AC. How was that connection with Adrian formed?
When Adrian started Calypso, I believe in 1994, he started in Concord's Calypso 10. And I would have been the band leader in the 10 at that time. And I...
What year, sir? Sorry? What year was it with this?
I believe it's 94. I think 94, 93, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
93, 94. And so I arranged his first... We worked together. His very first year, he had won the Teen Talent competition. He was a young artist coming out, and he was, delving in, jumping into Calypso. And I worked with him. I think he went to the finals.
1993. That's right.
1993. There you go. His first year. He sang something about domestic abuse, I believe. The domestic abuse or something about being poor. I can't remember because he's done so many songs over the years, but we just developed a bond, and I've worked with him almost every year since then. He's like a member of the family. He mm-hmm. comes over and we spend like 5 minutes on the music, and then he takes like 2 hours before he can leave the house.
That's AC.
Right,
but,
yeah. He's like a part of the family now.
Yeah, but it must be a pleasure, really, seeing that, because, of course, he's great now, and we all know how legendary AC is now. But at that time, he was good, yes. He was very promising, but he was not legendary yet. But from the start, could you see this longevity of being so great from so young and so long? Could you see this from the beginning for AC?
But you
can work with him?
You could see the talent. He had an incredible voice. And approach the music. I don't think he was writing his material as yet. He may have been collaborating with persons, I think. But over the years, he's developed that acumen too. From his very first year, the talent was there. It was noticeable. Incredible voice, incredible ear, and he learned the delivery because Calypso. It's not R&B, and singing in a tent is not the same thing, I think, as singing in a nightclub.
People respond
to you and heckle you if you're not that good and whatnot. And he learned really quickly the strengths that he needed, the skills that he needed to really deliver the Calypso. He would even possibly tell that he learned to woke up, because at the time there were Calypsonians and band members that tell him, but Adrian, you can't woke up, you got to learn to woke up, even that he learned, in a hurry. So
he learned everything. So here you mentioned about and responding with the audience and different things. As an arranger, you study those things as an arranger? Are those things important to you, or are those things you notice from being in the art form?
I think those are things that you notice being involved in the art form.
Okay.
Something that when I was at Berkeley, that was part of the course. You learned the techniques, the arranging techniques. You learned harmony, voice chords and that type of thing. But in terms of response and how to work with a musician, how to work with a singer, those are things that you learn on the job. And being involved and playing music, there's nothing that can beat experience, I think. And the and So being involved in the tent, in the whole atmosphere of the tent, and the night tonight, seeing how sometimes a song would hit, you know, for half the season, and then it wouldn't hit again for the other half of the season, and also playing in the band and playing other persons' arrangements, Smokey, and I was playing the tents from the '80s, from 85. And the arrangers for me of note at the time were people like Smokey Roy, and Mike Seeley. Mike Seeley, man, they did so many arrangements and so many great arrangements that I played. So I was able to not just hear them off stage, but be able to actually be part of rehearsals and then perform the pieces, you know, hear the harmonies the guys were using and whatnot. And again, seeing the reaction of the audience when, you know, the effect of a band, a really powerful band chorus, or sometimes the effect of things not being married well. You have a great arrangement, it sounds great in rehearsal, but then the Calypsonian can't carry it. You know, it's sometimes too much music for the Calypsonian, you know, because the Calypsonian is not as strong a performer and possibly needs something a lot simpler to be dressed in to make him effective. So those things you learn in the tent, and, you know, and they also always been playing music. So you play music in church, you play music on the hotel circuit, and you see how people react to the things that you do. And if you do pay attention, those things would influence how you write, how you arrange.
Well, you certainly heard you mention Berkeley, so we can go a bit back. You were doing music from how young?
From birth, sir. I think all of us do music. I think all of us do music from birth. We sing, and in terms of formal instruction, my mom had a desire to play piano, but was too poor, you know, to afford a piano. So when she was able to, she decided that her children would learn to play piano, and my parents sent us to piano lessons.
These stories, man. Your mom had a desire to play piano, so I said she was too poor to do it.
Right.
So she then made sure that you all could.
Yes. Right.
And this is how it started.
Yeah, but she grew up in a house with a lot of music. Her granddad and she had great uncles and great aunts that sang in choirs, and, you know, back in the service song days and whatnot. She had a great uncle that was a very good choir master. And so they learned solfa, and, you know, we call it solfege now. So she could read, you know, the syllables. She could pick up they had some old books that had the solfege syllables in it. She could pick up anything and read it. So she was very musical. She could sing a really good alto. But I think I gather that she really wanted to play piano. On my father's side now, my father had a sister that died fairly early. She was a school teacher, and she died fairly young. But one of the things that she did, she bought a piano, and that's the piano I have today. So going by my granddad, my father's father, there was a piano there that nobody played because my aunt had died. But they would pick up tunes, you know, they pick up tunes on it. And then on my mom's side, as I said, there was a lot of vocal music happening. So as children, we got sent to piano lessons, and my brother and sister didn't take to it as well as I did. And that was from around the age of 8 or so. So formal instruction for me in music started at 8, but there was always music, you know, music at church, music in your house. My sister and I, we grew up, there were not a lot of people. I grew up in St. Philip in the country, and we were almost surrounded by cane fields when I was, when I was growing up. So my sister and I would like create concerts, actually write up programs and with folk songs and things that we were hearing on the radio. We would sing them, you know, put the dogs in the bed as an audience. We would perform, you know, to them and stuff. So I guess that inkling for music was always there.
Okay, so, so, So you always knew that this is what you would be doing?
Not really, you know. Only from about third form. I love music, coming through primary school, secondary school, but it was only really, truly only in third form that it struck me that this is something that I really wanted to do. Nicholas Branca and I, we were in the same year group coming through Harrison College. And in third form, there were only 8 of us doing music, only 8 persons that opted to do music. And Nicholas was obviously one of them. And, I mean, Nicholas was just an incredible musician from then, right? He was just incredible. And one day, Nicholas came in and said he had written a song. And it had never occurred to me, to actually compose something. He always playing, other people's music and stuff. And I came home that night and I wrote something, and that was it for me. That was it. It was only like 8 bars. But Sluggy, I can tell you, I mean, that 8 bars felt like the most fantastic experience to me. And from then, just writing music, is an incredible joy for me, an incredible bit of satisfaction. And from then, that was it. This is what I wanted to do, I always wanted to teach, too. I wanted to teach. And I figured music would be great. If I love music that much to play it and write it, then I should also possibly teach it, too. So definitely from third form, that was the moment. As I said, Nicholas walked in one morning and said, "My guys, I write this song, he played it for us." And I was like, "Sure, but maybe I could write a song too, So that was it. That was the point.
Nice. Shout out to Nicholas for sure. Of course, you mean Branker.
Nicholas Branker, correct.
Yeah, where we know Nicholas Branker. You said from that age, he was already great. And you said from Terraform is still fairly young, especially going out of school here. Of course, you got great musicians there for sure. You, Nicholas Branker, many, many, many others. John Ritt.
Harrison College in the 70s. Under Janice Middleton was just an incredible place.
He's heard his name so much in circles from so many people, from Nicholas, from you. I heard daughter Stephan Walker spoke about her already. She was the person that was your teacher at school?
Yeah, Janice would have been my music teacher pretty much from first form. I had Miss Malikin lower first, but then from first form through to sixth form, it would have been Janice.
Janice Middleton, that is a very, very legendary name.
But I should also mention that at Harrison College, I played clarinet. I was not a piano player at Harrison College. There was a system and I think it's a fantastic system where you could learn an instrument for like $2 a term. And from lower first, you could learn a wind instrument. And from lower first, from my first term at Harrison College, I went to Janice and he said I wanted to play an instrument and I wanted to play a flute at first, and there were no flutes. And I said, "Well, I'll play a clarinet," and I was very fortunate to be taught by a guy by the name of Vince Allen, who would have been solo chair. So we had bandsmen who came into the school on evenings and taught instruments. Mr. Connell, we had Andy Williams taught flute.
Andy Williams was also a director of the festival band, and he was deputy director of the police band as well.
Correct.
It rains a lot for Gabby as well.
Yes. But Mr. Allen would have, just having him as a clarinetist, and I honestly did not realize how incredible a teacher he was until my first lesson at Berklee. Because at Berklee, I went to Berklee as a clarinetist, as a woodwind player, because I did really.
So, most of us know you from obviously piano.
Yeah.
So, you went to Berklee as a clarinet player, woodwind?
Yeah, because I went it from. Then from my first term at Harrison College, I started playing clarinet, did lessons with Mr. Vince Allen on evenings, and did grade eight and like in lower sits. And Janice told me to join the orchestra. It was Sinfonia at the time, the Barbados Sinfonia. So I was in sixth form playing in Sinfonia, and playing clarinet really well. So that was my instrument of choice. I still played piano, but I felt myself to be a clarinetist more so than a pianist. So clarinet was what I studied at Berkeley. And my very first lesson, my tutor, there was a guy by the name of Andre Lazotte. And he was blown away with how much I knew about the instrument, because he said, well, how's this, you know, this little fella come from, this island, this small island. And playing, you know, it didn't matter what scale he called, I could play, and they knew all the fingerings. You know, he said that he had students that would have been taught the instrument in the U.S. that did not know a lot of the things that I knew. You know, I knew alternate fingerings and that sort of thing, because Mr. Allen had taught us all that stuff. And that was, and to be honest with me, I just took it as a matter of course. You go in lessons on evenings with Mr. Allen. It's only at that point I realized that he, you know, the incredible teacher he was, and how well he had taught us in a very, you know, he never raised his voice, very unstated way. But, you know, sometimes you don't realize the value of things until you compare it, you know, until you get an opportunity to compare it to other persons, and in that case, international standards, you know.
And that is really, really great, I mean, for us as a nation, too, because you see, you're saying, and Berkeley, like, the top college, so you're saying you took your training from here over there, from a teacher here, but, you know, over there, there were impressed by your level of playing, and you attribute that to him. That's really great. These things that, you know, obviously you don't really hear about, but I think these things is speak well about how powerful music is, and how good we truly are.
Yeah.
How good we truly are. So how you got from the clarinet to the piano, in big gigs? When you say big gigs, I mean, like, you played in the festival band. Obviously, you studied to be a clarinet player, not piano. Right.
Yeah,
so how you got playing piano in Barbados so regularly? How that happened?
Well, one of the blessings, I think, in my life is that I've had some really true friends. Two of them, and most of them are musicians. Two of them that have influenced me immensely: David Weatherhead and Andre Woodvine.
Yeah, David Weatherhead, boy. You met him there, got called so much in there, called a lot with Adrian as well.
Yep, David studied accounts. Let me just start there. David studied accounts at the University of the West Indies. Teaches accounts, too. But, I mean, teaches music. But David is one of the most natural musicians I have ever met. And the first thing that impressed me was that we played together in the orchestra before he left for Berkeley. We played. He was the clarinetist in the orchestra too as well. And we hardly ever played clarinet parts. We would play. Janice would give us the other parts. So everything was missing in the orchestra at the time. The arrangement that she brought in, bassoon parts, whatever. And I would struggle to play these things that were in different clefs and different transpositions and stuff. And David would just read them, you know, as a matter of course. And I was wondering, how could this guy, you know, how this guy so talented, you know, could do this? And we became very good friends from then. And my first year at Berkeley, Bellhead calls me and said, well, look, you coming home for summer, buy a saxophone. And so I bought a saxophone because we were going to play in the tents. Sluggy, I had not even ever set foot in a tent before then. On the radio, I had never been in a tent. And they had told me to buy a saxophone, and we played in Southern Stars. I played tenor sax, and they had played alto. So I was playing saxophone in the tent from 85, not keyboards, saxophone. And then in 86, we moved to Concord's. And we were playing in Concord's from 86. And in 88, when I graduated, just before I graduated from Berkeley, Weatherhead called me and told me, well, look, he could find a sax player, but he's struggling to find a keyboardist. Buy a keyboard and play keyboards in the tent in 88. Well, I did. I bought a keyboard in the U.S.
So just like that.
Just just like that, right?
So because out of necessity.
Necessity. But I was playing. I mean, I even though I wasn't taking lessons, I was always playing. I was still playing keys, you know. But it was
okay.
Formally. And then in 88, Weatherhead was also playing in the festival band, and the guy who played up until that point, Campbell, forget his first name now, Grenadian guy, he went back to Grenada, and they were looking for a keyboardist, and Weatherhead recommended my little Roger could do this, right? He could read and thing, because the guy before, he didn't read, he used to memorize all the parts, which can sometimes be a struggle because the semifinals, if you remember, it used to be 36 tunes to learn in a week.
Yes.
36 tunes. So
in a week also?
Yeah. In less than a week, usually. It's like 4 days, really. So being able to read was an asset. So I got recommended, and Smokey Roy was the band leader at the time.
Nice. Smokes.
So I became a part of the festival band. And that same year, he was ahead of me at Harrison College, but we were almost neighbors. He grew up in St. Philip. I lived in Union Road. He lived in Orchardson, and during the summers, we would play. I would go by him, and he had an old upright in his house, and I would play tunes. I would play piano, and he would improvise on sax. So he told me, well, when I graduated, cause I say he was 2 years ahead of me, but he said when I graduated, we could form a band together. I would play keys, he would play sax, and we would do the hotel circuit, and the rest is history. So I was playing keys during the summer in the festival band, and then once the hotel season started, tour season started in December, I was playing with Woodvine, trying to remember the name of it, Double Explosion or something like that, which was another name that a group used then afterwards. But it was just the two of us. We sequenced some of the stuff, sequenced the bass lines. And we played together for a few years before he got snapped up by Spice.
Oh, nice. This was before the Spice. You're right. Before the Spice. And those are names that turn out to be very great. Like, you know, because I've been taught by Mr. Weatherhead at BCC. I'm going to say he's like the pick of the litter, creme de la creme. He's very, very, very good. His brain is extremely sharp. And when he teaches you, like, everybody got to be on point. It ain't like no B's and C's. Everybody got to be on point. He don't accept nothing but ears. And everybody in class got everyone in the class had to come to that standard too, so again, the witness greatness a little. And Woodvine is just incredible. I mean, everybody may not be musical, but something you saw him did already, the man was like improvising, and then can't let the key best send me to annoy him, improvising different things like that. And then, but you know, I see you do it a lot extensively, but then I remember hearing you speak in a class today, you were teaching us, and you were telling us a story about you saw Wolverine doing that with the CN Festival band or something.
Yeah. I give you two pit stories.
And I thought that was just incredible.
I give you two pit stories about those guys. Like,
Weatherhead
is disciplined, very disciplined, very disciplined guy. You know that from his
class. Very.
Weatherhead says 9 o'clock. You know it's 9 o'clock, you know? He's very punctual, always prepared, etc. And when we first started playing in the tents were not that. You know, the tents were very easy. And you may have advertised 9 o'clock and start at 9:30, and that upset the tents to the max.
It still happened, Ronnie.
Okay.
Let me just stress that that's not the case at virtually every tent that I attend. I think with about 5 tents now, all of them started on time when I went to them last year.
Right.
All.
And I'll tell you, back in the 80s, that was not true. And when Weatherhead became band leader in Conquerors, Weatherhead said, if the tent advertises for 9, it must start at 9.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the Calypsonians, the first night, you know, the Saint Calypsonians turned up late, because they didn't want to be on first or second and that sort of thing. And David told management that if all the clips, so if the whole cast was not present an hour before the tent was ready to start, the band would not play. You understand? And the second night, Saint Fellas still turn up, but they turn up before 9, but everybody was supposed to be there by 8. Redhead looked at his watch and said, okay, it's 8 o'clock, not everybody was there. Look at the band, said, all right, guys, let's go. And pack up and start to walk. The venue was Solidarity House. That was our home base. And started to walk. I can tell you, the management ran behind Redhead and begging, you know. And he said, look, this must stop. And Sluggy, from the third night, everybody was there at 8 o'clock. You understand? And the tent used to start at 9. And his thing was that all members of the cast had to be there at least an hour before. And the tent had to start at 9. And that became one of the big characteristics and marketing points for Conquerors, and that's because of David Redhead, because they call Untouchables and Battleground. They used to start late, and the one thing you could depend on, that when you went to Conquerors would start on 9. At 9, I can tell you, one night we started without the drummer. The drummer had forgotten. He had locked his outfit in the car. And so even though he was there early, he couldn't get in his car to get his stuff out. And the guys just fighting with hangers and things, trying to open his car. At 9 o'clock, the tent started without the drummer. I kid you not, because...
but once it's set, it's going to set a standard, set a precedent. So that's always great. Everything is run smooth and we've got art and discipline.
Yeah. So it's something that I've admired about him, and it's something I've tried to emulate. Not done it very well, but I've tried to emulate. You know?
So if I had to ask you an arrangement that you did over the years, one that you still, obviously you feel very, very proud about all, but you mean one that might linger in your mind still, or one that you got a special place for more than the others?
Boy, that's a difficult one. That's real difficult. There are arrangements that I have done that I feel really good about. A lot of them. 86, I did Tribute to the Skipper, John King.
Yes.
The band, I feel really good about the band. Of course, the idea of having the Rule Britannica thing up front. Like, I always try to look at the lyrics and the character of the song and try to write music that fits the lyrics and what the message is supposed to be portraying. Lord, that's a very difficult question. There are some arrangements. I did a thing for Sammy Dello. This is a good few years back.
Marijuana?
Marijuana.
Okay.
Yeah, about that. It felt really good too about some stuff that I've done for Ian Webster.
Yes.
Ian is very, very specific and very particular about what he wants. So a lot of the stuff I've done for him, I feel really good about Hollywood Tree.
Hollywood Tree is the year of the gymnasium, that's the year back one.
2012.
But nice.
Yeah, Things You Do for Love. I feel pretty good about that too.
Oh, that's another nice one. That's a really nice arrangement too.
Thanks, man. Stuff I've done for Adrian. Quite a bit of stuff I've done for Adrian too, because usually with Adrian, not always, but he tends to operate fairly close to the deadlines.
it's not really kind, but I love how you put it. You are so nice and sweet of a person. How you put it. Not always, but he usually tends to cut close.
The master of the understatement.
Go ahead, Rod. Sorry.
Adrian would come with a song. There was a year that I think Put Down Your Song.
Put Down Your Song. Mm.
Adrian turn up at the college. I was at the college. He called me in the morning and told me he did judging. It was a Thursday. They judging the Friday, and he got rehearsal the Thursday night. Turn up at lunch and we read the song, right? And
they
read the song.
Go ahead. Turn up at lunch.
Right. About real lunch time. Arrange the song for him then to rehearse the night, and I can't remember.
Anyway, wait. Slow down. The lunch time. You arranged the song for which night?
For the same night.
And everybody, right? Of course, our good friend around your friend too. So he's glad you do this. Could call you.
I can tell you. I can tell you the impact of that song, because I was at the rehearsal, and from the time that song was rehearsed for the first time, that was it. That was game over. That was it. 2008, and he had. I am a Bajan as well, and he won at Kensington Oval. That was the first year it went back to Kensington Oval after many years away from there.
You are correct, Ronnie.
It was game over. I was at the rehearsal at Queen's College, and he was playing it in the car, because he had like a CD track of the instrumental or something. If I'm not mistaken, I think he recorded it by Ian Aline, correct? As Ramam Studios.
I think so.
And from the time we heard it, it was like, that's it. It's all over.
Yeah.
Last year,
I am fairly sure the Christmas at Cropover, he would have rehearsed that at the song check.
But Roger,
Ronnie, I honestly see that Adrian does this because it works so well.
Well, he's capable of doing it because he's brilliant. And Roger, I want to say that, having had a chance to consistently go back to that song Christmas in Cropover, you always hear something different every time you listen to it. A lot of people ignore the little Christmassy melodies and touches that you have all throughout the song, and the transition and the transitions as well. And from a musical perspective, as an instrumental work, it stands out by itself. Then to put them lyrics on top of it, because I went to the judging night at the big show, and what was presented at finals was nothing like the performance on recording. In fact, the performance at recording night was so weak. And with so many strong performances in the big show that night, it was felt that he may not even get into the finals, which was similar to 2012, when Jude, his cousin, Hee-haw, he had a big song about Alexandra's school. Seven people went from the 10 or 8, and Jude didn't go. And Adrian barely got in as maybe the last of the persons getting in, because it, for some reason, it's hard to explain. It doesn't happen every judging night, let me tell you that. But on those two particular nights, one in a big show and that one at All Stars, it just didn't seem right. Something seemed wrong, but it was just enough to get in. And I think if you look at the points, 2012, he would have squeezed in. But then you had a semifinals, and you would have to work yourself from preliminary to semifinals and into finals. And what he did on more than one occasion, I think, during semi-finals and in finals, is he changed his songs when he got to the finals. In fact, he changed his songs during preliminaries and would come and sing a new song. Crowd Response was another song that he sang for the first time in 2010 at the Plantation. So if you really know what you're talking about, you have to recognize the brilliance of being able to do that and do it well. But that Christmas in Cropover, and there are lots of lyrics in there that people are just blown away by, you know, the costuming and the presentation. But if you look at that song lyrically, like clause, there was a clause. Clause was in the contract every since. That's correct. In there, but people don't understand that.
That's incredible. Like,
there you go.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Right? That's true. So maybe we're raising Adrian answer that, or you took that from the song, like the different elements that Ronnie's spoke about, the different Christmassy elements you were putting in the music with the instruments. Adrian answered that, or that was you on your own, Rog?
Well, we've worked together for so long now. He would have known. That's why he would have looked at. That's why he would have done. And he suggested, it got to be Christmas stuff. So I started to think of what, you know, after he left, what are the tunes that could work given what the progression was. And not every tune that he thought of worked, but some of them did. And you try to manipulate them in a way that they're tasteful, because you don't want it to sound forced. You know, you want it to sound tasteful. So Ronnie's very correct that the arrangement at the initial arrangement that he would have done in the tent and for judging is a different. There's so much stuff, more stuff added to the final thing, because then I had time to work on it. You know, that's why I definitely feel good about. Terry's the stuff I did for Terry last year too.
That was her first time in finals too.
Yes. Yeah, and when she sang the song to me, some songs just speak to you immediately, and they were just ideas, you know, ideas. The ideas just came really readily, you know, came readily. Sometimes I have to put down stuff and go back to it and whatnot. But with hers, with that particular song, you know, once I started, everything just flowed, you know. So that happens sometimes. Sometimes, as I said, sometimes you got to put it down and go back to it. And stuff, but
yeah. You also did some arrangements for people that, for personally, like us, especially when it was at BCC checking on all the music. So like how you were disciplined enough to do this, and like how you hear the ideas. Being, but you are so trained, how you still stick and give a really good arrangement. Like I'm certainly heard you spoke about. I'm arranging for Juke Chat. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was speaking about Juke Chat, and you said, well, everyone's out, you know, Sluggy.
Yeah. But I love working with Juke, too.
I heard you say this already.
Yeah. To be honest, I enjoy writing music, period. And I work with the juniors, as you know, and Juke is special, because Juke comes from a different space. You know, to everybody else. And usually when Juke turns up by me, Juke come in with a book, you know, and we go through the book, and looking for the song that we figure is going to be the song that will hit this year. And what I try to do with somebody like Juke is give him enough space that he can be Juke, and then I can do my stuff, like maybe need band chorus, but give him enough space that he can maneuver and do his stuff, you know. So just also think of the drama of what he's going to create and try to bring that out too in the music. So I enjoy working with him, you know.
Yes, bigger Juke man, a good man, very hard working man too. Yeah. So salute to Juke Tech for sure. You spoke about arrangements and working with John, who's no minister,
mm-hmm.
John King.
Yeah.
But for me, knowing John before, like musically, John was lit. I used to be amazed from young, like hearing John sing different genres, or even hearing the stuff he sang Calypso. I liked it. No, he's had a lot. Talk back then about your style, but you obviously like John's style. Mm-hmm. But as a vocalist, listen to John as a vocalist, he was very, very rich. But speaking to him, like of late, Rog, after he got bigger, and John's knowledge of music also is incredible. Even if he didn't know what he's hearing, he could sing it and tell you, and man, you play like what?
Correct.
I mean, like, John is here some things, like, nines and things. I'm telling you, yes, like, he put it there.
Mm-hmm.
How was that experience working with him then?
Mm-hmm. Well, my first experience with John would have been my very first year in Concord's tent, which was only my second year of arranging. And the
Oh, nice, boy. Your second year in tent? Sorry.
Yeah, because they started in 85. My first summer back.
Mm-hmm.
I would only have done 1 year at Berkeley. And the cool thing about Berkeley is that Berkeley really teaches you useful stuff that you can use in the industry. So one of the mandatory courses is arranging one and arranging two. So having done that my first year, I was able to do arrangements coming back in the summer, my first summer back. And then the second summer back, we were in Conquerors, and John has an incredible ear. John, he started getting rehearsal, would be telling the backup vocals what notes to sing. You know, he has that sort of ear.
Yes.
I'm working with John, like if you play a particular chord, he said, no, not that chord. And he can't articulate it because he doesn't form a train. He doesn't play guitar or piano or anything. But once you move around, he says, that's the chord he wants. You know, so he's actually hearing the chords in his head when he writes. So that part of it makes it easy, and the fact that he can sing makes it even easier. So the relationship with us from 86 was started. I didn't come back in 87, and he would have worked with Mike Seeley, I think, and then he started to work with Kenny. Oh Lord, last name beating me now. A guy out of Trinidad. So he's worked with a number of different arrangers and stuff. But working with John, he's very, very musical. He knows what he wants. He can sing it. If he can't tell you what it is, he will sing it. He will sing it for you. And he hears stuff. He's not going to sing out of tune at any point or not. He can hear the harmonies really, really well. So
Yeah, that was something about him that amazed me. Seeing him in rehearsal, like being able to sing backups with Jack Nate time and hear John singing all the cards, mm-hmm. and then we may play the wrong card. You know, John realizing before some musicians and saying no, mm-hmm. the wrong one I talk, wrong note I talk with the card, mm-hmm. and it was playing incredible. So that was great to hear that from Dan. You noticed that from Dan, and you both of you had to be very young. You had to be very young at the time because it was your.
Yeah.
After first summer coming back from Berkeley.
In 85, I was 21.
Yeah, it's very young, I think.
Because I spent a year, before I went to Berkeley, I spent a year teaching, just mm-hmm. to make sure this is what I really wanted to do. serious. So I taught for a year at Princess Margaret, mm-hmm. Taught music, and I realized from the experience I really needed to learn how to teach, because I really wanted to teach, but I did not have the tools and the techniques. And that's one of the things that Berkeley does very well that is not usually spoken about. Berkeley has a very good music education program, and I learned a lot of useful things. You know, I was able then, when I came back to Barbados, I was able to tailor the techniques to work in our system here. You know, and yeah, so that worked really well.
Yes, and I was be able to witness that from early, from like around 93, probably 92, 93, 94, around there. It was at St. Leonard's. I saw you on Pernell link up quite a bit. And to me, it was normal. But then you realize, well, everyone, it don't happen with every school coming home speaking. They say it don't normally happen because we like play at like Princess Margaret. Mm-hmm. We play at Springer School, play up with Law School, and St. Lawrence Band and some of your men from law school. That's where I actually met Dean Bascom, was another incredible musician. I think I met Dean, you were at law school, you were at BCC as yet.
Correct. Yeah, in 93.
Yeah, but some really good names too, like Dean and Edwin Gamble, man, quite a few. We can't even start calling names, no, you know, people get offended because it's too many.
Yeah,
too many.
Yeah.
And I find the amazing thing about this that we speak about is that a lot of the guys still doing music at full time, like from that time, like from secondary school to BCC, I know. Why you wanted to teach, and why if it was always your dream to teach in the schools, or you always had a dream of teaching at college? Because I meet you first teaching at secondary school.
My original dream would have been to teach at secondary school. I honestly did not want to teach primary school. I take my hat off to primary school teachers. Primary school teachers are some of the most what would I say, are not given the sort of love and recognition that they deserved. The energy you need primary school and the ability to motivate students and to keep them engaged. There are some people who do it naturally and some persons who just should be not be in the system at all because
it's I got a lot of very great teachers. I met you obviously through BCC, the BCC connection, from originally was good from BCC, but thank you teaching at primary school. I see him children is really, really good. Got a few, but when it's like watching them do it thoroughly, I feel like this is incredibly hard. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And you gotta have a love. You gotta have a real love for children, and you have an arsenal of techniques because children learn in different ways, and to keep their attention. Especially in the age where you are competing against the internet and game, toys and the Game Boys and all that sort of thing. Primary school teachers have to be really special these days. For me, I knew I did not have that patience, and I wanted to teach at a higher level too. There was no BCC music program when I went to Berkeley, so it didn't even occur to me to teach university. I wanted to teach secondary school. Because that's what I knew, and for me, going to Lodge, I taught Lodge almost 10 years, and that's the best 10 years I've had teaching.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, man. When I first went to Lodge, there, people told me, "Why are you going to Lodge school? Your children are this bad and that sort of thing." And to be honest, when I got to Lodge school, I had a few characters that were, scallywags and things, but generally the children were like any other children you'll find anywhere, students you'll find in any other school. Mm. And some real talented guys. You mentioned Basker, man.
Yeah, man.
Jerome, those are
Jerome Clark, who's not needed, the Junior Monarch band.
Correct. I actually taught them they sang in the junior choir and then there's guys like Dave Chapman as well. There's a youngster, Brett Blackman, who's living and working now in the Bahamas, incredible keyboardist. But there are a number of guys that and ladies too that I taught at Lodge that are involved in music, and some who are not involved in music that when they meet today, the experience of being in the choir or playing in the band has molded them into incredible, fantastic and meaningful human beings. I really enjoy the 10 years, and we had bands. We had a junior band, a senior band. We had on the Lynchfield Nurse,
Yes.
We had a small wind ensemble going. We had a choir, junior choir, senior choir. There was a lot of music happening. And just to say, you realize the strengths of other persons. So Pernell taught for a year or two years or so at law school.
Mm.
And I give you a story about Pernell. Pernell had not left yet to go and study music education formally. And he would teach half the first forms music. I taught the other half. And his first formers used to play the recorder better than my first formers. I said, how come I do 4 years of Berkeley, right? And my first formers, can't play as well as Pernell, who will be first. what is that you're doing? And he had developed a technique of dividing the class into groups and had them practicing at lunch and had one person, what we call collaborative learning and thing, a big name and thing. But Pernell was doing that back in 1989, 1990, and I'm not sure if it's something he had learned somewhere, if he come up with it himself. But Pern is one of the most natural music teachers and a motivator too. Get people to give of their best. So Yeah, so I learned stuff from Pernell. You know,
that's incredible. Pernell was my first music teacher. And when you saw me, like, years, you see, like, St. Aaron's Band coming out to law school, I was coming out there because I was at school giving trouble. And Pernell Dean asked anyone, Pernell see me, and all of you, if you use the devil, go inside that music room. Pick two instruments that you want. You know what I mean? Tell me, take whichever ones they want. You know, get in trouble, and the boy treated me like this. And he tell me, let me tell you, know what I'm saying? No, if you get trouble, you can't touch him again. And then I check his fear. Like, straight talk. And it's from there how we started doing music. In the next couple of days, I learned to play the drums and the flute. I learned the songs that he threw them playing by myself. And then he take me, and WTS take us around. And I was trying to learn on my own. And then putting up coming in like 5 minutes, playing everything flute. 5 minutes of the playing 4 or 5 different songs on the drums. After explaining for 5 minutes, show me what to practice and how to practice and how to learn it, the fast way to learn it, and then go back out there and pick it down later, make sure you make the gig and do what needed for the gig. Certain little things. He's Raj Pernell, incredible.
Yeah. He's one of those teachers. He's a real teacher. He's able to look at what you're doing, break it down, and tell you what you need to do. And that's what teaching is, you know. Being able to analyze what somebody's doing and give them the technique, the path to move from point A to point B, you know, and not just that, be able to carry sometimes you gotta take them with you. Sometimes you gotta provide the environment, you know, to get them to that point as well. He's able to do that. And he's done it on many, many occasions, I can say. You know?
Yeah, man. Salute to all those great ones. I really, really, really enjoyed our conversation today. I want to thank you for doing such a wonderful job. You know, about 3 people that changed my life. You know, you are one for sure. I'm Pernell Farley for sure. And meeting you back then, how you treat us, because you've never seen us before, but you just treat us like if it was one of your children. Like, normally, it wasn't even anything you study or think about. And, like, for me, I think it was like, this music seems like it can work, yeah. Because you know your first experience, what can really make you or break you, if you want to be a musician.
True.
So, in their first experiences, I want to thank you for being such a gentleman. I thank you for teaching so many great love. A lot of them locked on. Lori just messaged me and tell me he locked on. I'm loving it. So Lori, for sure. Sir, you're doing an incredible job, BCC. Any hopes in the future, before we go, any hopes in the future of a full degree program at BCC in music?
You know the weird thing about it is I think that this COVID experience will force us to move in that direction. We attempted to go that route in 2013. Funding fell through. You know, we were starting to write the syllabus and everything, but we need the infrastructure. But what COVID has taught us is that so much can be done online. So you don't necessarily need the space. You do need facilities, but we don't necessarily need the amount of space that we
needed before.
So but we're doing so much stuff online now. I think it augurs well. It might mean then that we can move sooner rather than later towards the degree. What I'm thinking is that we need to think not regionally, but we got to think internationally. That
yes.
One of my maxims is that if Elia Burke, who started Berkeley, Burke started Berkeley in his apartment in Newbury Street in Boston. You understand? And in 20 years, it became a university, and in another 20 years, it was world renowned.
That's serious. That's what Berkeley started, like, legendary, the world famous Berkeley College of Music.
Yeah, he realized there was a market. There was leaving the army at the end of World War II. They had army bands and stuff, lots of army bands, and people were being furloughed. They were leaving the army, coming back into civilian life. But they had skills. They had music skills. They could play, and jazz was in its in its heyday, bebop and whatnot. And there were persons who played music, but they didn't have the formal training in jazz and pop music. There were conservatories that were doing classical music, but there was not an institution doing jazz in a formal way and doing arranging and stuff in a formal way. He started to give lessons in his his apartment, and from there it blossomed, you know, into university. So there's no reason why we can't market, as you guys keep saying, Bajan music and what Bajans do. You know, that we arrange stuff in a particular way, we write things. And I mean, Calypso is one of the most unique, is there such a thing, art forms when it comes to composition in the world. You know, and only Calypso you can talk from love, politics, you know, to risque things to the environment, to religion. You could talk about anything in Calypso, and that's
very true.
We could market to the world, right? And
timing different. That common time is time very different.
Exactly. So there are things that are very unique and peculiar to us that we can market, you know. And we don't need 1,000 people, you know. We need 200 people to make it work, you know. So and the great thing for the economy is that those are going to be persons who are going to be paying foreign exchange to do the course online or come into Barbados to get the experience, you know. And they're going to stay.
That's cool.
They're not going to stay for a week. They can stay here for a couple of months, you know, maybe a year. So,
Yes. You
know, it augurs well. It's something that we really do need to pursue, not just from a music point of view, but from an economic, right, economic point of view, you know.
Yes, and we've had some good overseas students before who were absolutely amazing, like many, many overseas students who were amazing. And what you just said sent bells through my head, because I could see people, for like you said, our Caribbean music, and how you write and arrange our music is different. And then what BCC can offer through yourself and many others who are worldly. You know, they got like Dr. Walcott, Andrea Woodvine, you could go on, Van der Bosch. They're all worldly at the highest level. And I'm sure that foreign exchange and the economy could really do good with that call. People will do that for sure. Very sure if you are launched that, no. Mm-hmm. People will do it. And you say you don't need... You just need a couple hundred, and for sure, you know, if you do that online, you get a couple hundred for sure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the interest is there. We have saw people asking about it online already, and you can see from the comments and who the people are. They are very, very ready and committed. When BCC was doing the Entertainment Manager Program, a lot of people requested to do it, the degree program that you have or had.
Mm-hmm.
You see them learning, those other girls were doing it. A lot of people request to do it, so I'm sure I like that idea, sir. For sure, online we can't do it. So hopefully the right people here, and it can happen, because you sound ready and willing.
Yeah, man. That's my next goal, to make sure it happens. So
yes, that's what we're talking about, and it will happen. We ain't got no doubts, no negative thoughts, and nothing. We are saying we would love it to happen, and we are sure that in the near future it's going to happen. That's what we're talking. Sir, really appreciate you for speaking to us today. Thanks a lot for all the great work over the years. And of course, you know, you may not say it yourself, but in all realms, you are a legend. You are a very legendary dude. You did legendary things. And
I really hope
that this is not the last time that we can have a conversation on air, for people to really know who Roger Gittings is. And thanks for arranging such beautiful music. And before you go, sir, are your music available still? Because you had wonderful arrangements, especially for the church. Remember seeing the music online, hearing the music online through Facebook and through Kings Kelly did you also, and you were doing it in church, you had a church tour. So your music still available there?
Yeah, you can contact me for, if believe it or not, CDs. But there is stuff on YouTube, and I have not put it on Amazon or iTunes, but definitely if you...
And the problem, because still got a CD from you now, right?
Yeah, you can still. Yeah,
wait, just let me know online. Just let Roger get his office number and send a message.
And send me a message.
Hi, Roger.
Hey, Ronnie.
You have to get in contact with Gail at Costcap, as we've been advertising for the past 6 weeks, and prepare to get your music on Star Tunes as well, where Barbadian content is going to be, you know?
Yes, definitely.
And I just wanted to say, it would appear as though we've been following Facebook and many people like Arturo Tappin and so on, have been commenting on the news of the passing of a contemporary of yours, a gentleman who was very actively involved in Cropover. No stranger to VOB microphones, and him and Dennis had a tremendous relationship. Gentleman by the name of Derry Atkins apparently has passed. So Roger, your thoughts on that, because I'm sure you would have worked with Derry at some point.
Boy, Ronnie, that That is a shock. It's so unexpected. I would have, we would have been messaging each other over the last couple of months, you know, during the lockdown and stuff. So this is really, you know, it floored me. But there are a number of things. But one thing I would like to say about Derry is that Derry believed in Caribbean music.
Yes.
Believed to the max. And if you check the arrangements that he did over the years, one of the things that he told me was, you know, Tuck, we got to market Tuck music in you know, Tuck and Spooge in a more meaningful way. The stuff that he did for the CBU Song Festival, his arrangement,
yes.
he slowed down the Tuck beat. So if you listen to like Musical Matrimony, check arrangements like that he did, where he was attempting to take Tuck and Spooge into pop music, into, you know, the mainstream pop music. He's a guy, they said, that believed in the power and the significance of what we were doing in the Caribbean. And that's something that I would like people to recognize, you know, and to be said about him, you know, that he was a true ambassador for Caribbean music.
Caribbean music, it's true. Mm-hmm. It's very, very true. I can't believe this one. We get the news just before we came on. I can't believe it either, because my interaction with Derry was always pleasant. And when it comes to Caribbean music, he will always mention it to me. It's like, you got the youth for your hand. You know, the old people love you. Push the Caribbean music. It's like, we got to go on money to make different projects he's wanted to do in Guyana. The projects he did here. I will ask about arrangements. My dad was, and he was always, and he was, listen, he's something that you watch when you're teaching, like, you would try to teach her as much as possible, like, try to teach us everything you know, well, and in class, and outside the class, you would, Derry talk to you, and he'd try to give you everything you need, or as much as he know, you know, like, he's not going to talk to you and then brush you off, he's going to try to give you everything you need before he finishes to speak to you, and just want to see his condolences to all his family and friends. Right now at this very hard time. Rog, it's been a pleasure, it's been a blessing, and it really, 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 I mean, respect the work that you are doing and continue to do. And thanks for always being there, and thanks for saying yes. And I hope you have an enjoyable night, and throughout these trying times, I hope you and your family stay as safe as possible, and I wish you nothing but the best, sir.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, sir. And Mr. Ronnie Clark.
Indeed.
It's been great. It's been great. It's been legendary. Thank you very much for putting up with me. And thanks for always. Thanks for that fabulous brain you have to remember the dates. And I hope you have a good night as well, my brother. And I hope you get home safely. And I wish everyone at VOB and all of our listeners a great night and great rest of the weekend. This is your boy, Sluggy Dan. This was Bajan Rhythm and Rhyme, and I'm out.
Thank you, Sluggy. Thank you, Roger. A blessing, a privilege, and an honor for me to be in studio with you two gentlemen. And of course, as we collectively salute the memory of Derry Atkins, and I'm sure as the week goes by, we get a chance to hear from many others that would have had the opportunity to learn from and to share experiences with Derry. Thank you, Roger. And thank you, Sluggy.